vendors who list with her this month.
Welcome to the Deco Retro program here on Planet FM. We will bring you interesting interviews, updates of future deco, modern, retro, and other related events. Also the stories that celebrate New Zealand's history and its people, as well as book reviews and other snippets capturing the glamour and fascination of a bygone era.
Deco Retro, Deco Retro.
Good afternoon, listeners. We are fortunate to have in the studio today a very talented early New Zealand potter, Mr. Peter Longy. A most modest man, his pottery and sculptures are in many collections and much admired by many New Zealanders and also internationally. He was born in Otahuhu, went to school there, and after a couple of years at the School of Architecture, did the fashionable thing and dropped out. He travelled for 5 years with his wife, Ro, going overland to the UK and, on the way, worked for 5 years at odd jobs, including building sites, driving taxis, and at one stage at Buckingham Palace cleaning silver. Back home in 1973, he chanced across a couple of old friends who were involved with making pottery. Within 6 months, he had built a kiln and learnt the basics of pottery, and so a career that would cover 47 years working with clay was born. He loves solving technical problems and trying new techniques, and this curiosity led him into sculptural work in the 1980s and eventually into brick sculptures. He received the MNZM a couple of years ago for his work with the Auckland Studio Potters Society, managing the organisation and teaching there. Now he is working part-time, but still endlessly experimenting. His latest works are trip rugs, solid tiled rugs with wrinkles in them to trip over. Good afternoon, Peter. Lovely to have you on the program today.
Thank you, Nancy. It's great.
Now, after sort of doing your thing overseas, you came back to New Zealand about 1973.
73, yeah.
Yeah. Right. And you actually started potting, I think, in Bombay. Was that right?
Yeah, South Auckland. Yeah, I had a job with an old friend from school. He had 2 days a week for me to work, and I had a few days every week to spare. And I managed to, just by serendipitous reasons, ended up living just about a kilometre from another old friend who was a potter. Another old friend turned up with a wheel that he wanted stored somewhere.
Yeah.
So everything sort of fell into place. So I was very lucky at that time.
Yeah, good. Yeah. And then you sort of went to live in Warkworth, is that right?
Yeah.
Because by that time you had a family and...
Well, I had one child and I'd built my first kiln at Bombay, and then we... the motorway was getting closer and closer. It was costing us $8 a week to stay there. Mm-hmm. So we moved out to the country up near Warkworth, actually in the Kuiper Hills, above Warkworth. Yeah, we could see both coasts from our letterbox. It was an amazing place.
Mm-hmm.
But in the middle of nowhere, really.
Right. Mm. So you were sort of on a farm type of thing.
Yeah, back in those days when you wanted to make pots, you really had to get out of town, you know, because you're usually firing with diesel. And a bit of smoke coming out. You couldn't do that in the city.
Yes.
Eventually, of course, in the 80s, the gas kiln thing happened and we all moved back to the city. But in those days, if you're firing with wood or diesel, you made a bit of smoke.
So
farmers often had a spare house to, you know, just you could rent, and it was a great system, arrangement, actually, yeah.
Bit different to these days.
Yes, yeah.
Now, you also started a sort of cooperative shop in Albany with 14 other potters, was that right?
Yeah, sure, that's
right. I do actually remember that shop being there many years ago.
It was very popular. That was about 75, and a couple of people found this old shed, really, on the main road of Albany, and they scouted around for other people in the area and as far away as Warkworth. And eventually 15 of us joined forces, and we became quite a solid group for 20 years or
right.
so. And
yes.
the idea was that we went down there every 15 days and served in the shop.
Yes.
And it lowered the costs a lot, and it was very collegial and very... it was a good group of friends, really.
Right.
Half of them are not with us anymore, which is a bit sad. But,
gosh.
But that's right. But it worked very well, and we were there over 20 years. And
yes.
In fact, we ended up buying the land the shop was on and rebuilding the shop. And we built the shop ourselves in 3 weeks. So it was
gosh.
A pretty practical group of people, actually. Mm. Yeah.
Well, that's tremendous. And you weren't paying out...
No,
commissions to that was really excellent idea. I think about 1975 you moved to Mount Eden and you started another shop there. I think it was called the Potter's Arms, is that right?
That's right. It was a little bit after, about 1979, 1980, we moved into Dominion Road. So we left the isolation of the Kuiper Hills, nobody ever drove past, to living on a shop above Dominion Road. So it was quite a big jump.
Yes.
And but, you know, it turned out to be a really good move as well, because I guess, if I'm honest, I really am a bit of an urban sort of person.
Mm.
And we lived above the shop, and we worked downstairs and ran a little shop, shop front in the window.
Is that the Auckland Meat Company?
Yes, the Auckland Meat Company building.
Oh,
yes,
okay.
It's now a barber shop.
Yes.
The barber shop, which is a bit ironic because most of us had very long hair at the time. But anyway, I had the kiln out the back.
Yes.
And the shop out the front and the bedrooms upstairs. And my youngest daughter was born upstairs, so...
Oh, okay.
Yes, there should be a plaque on the wall, really.
Yes, there should be. Was that what sort of a kiln was it?
It was a big gas kiln. One of the first gas kilns in Auckland, yeah.
Mm. Now, about this time, or it's probably a bit later, you started exploring the super realistic style of ceramic sculpture after being influenced by, I think he was from San Francisco, Richard Shaw. Can you tell us about Richard a bit?
Well, I'll just go back a little step because for those 5 or 6 years up until then, I'd been making a lot of domestic ware, which is functional.
Oh, okay,
mugs, teapots. Mm. And that was what sold in New Zealand because there was a big hole in the market. There's a big political story behind this, which we don't need to go into necessarily, but it was very hard to get imported goods of any sort in New Zealand.
Right.
And so a lot of the potters thrived in that vacuum, if you like.
Yeah.
And so we had an endless market. We could make anything which was round and had a hole in the middle and was brown, you could probably sell it, you know. But, and of course...
Well, we all had pottery in our houses,
right.
didn't we?
And we all got sort of better as we went on and got more skillful.
Mm.
But I must say, I was looking at overseas magazines and meeting occasionally overseas potters. I was quite captivated by the more sculptural approach to clay.
Yes. Mm.
And while I didn't completely give up the functional thing, because I think it's in my makeup...
Mm.
I found it really hard to make something which was stood alone as a sculptural object.
Yes.
Which I do now, but it's taken 20 years to get to that point.
It's totally different, really, isn't
so
it?
So yes. Richard Shaw turned up here as an international judge in a competition.
Oh.
And I got to know him a little bit while he was here. Then I went and visited him in the States as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so he used to collect found objects, make molds of them, and then try and imitate them so they looked exactly like the original objects. But then he would combine them into sculptural elements.
Right.
Well, I did the same thing. I collected concrete blocks and bricks and bits of wood and anything I could lay and went around the toy shops and assembled them. But I still made them into functional objects, like teapots.
Mm.
And they're most unlikely teapots. So one of them might look like a bath sponge and they have a reinforced rod handle, you know. But
they worked.
They
worked. Poured.
Yeah, that was I was quite... Yeah, I'm quite insistent that they did work. I hadn't quite made that jump yet from functional to non-functional.
Mm.
But, so that was the sort of thing that started me off on my more experimental aspects of my life.
Because a lot of your sculptures, like people, how can I put it, they're like community-minded people can... Did you make a chess set of some sort?
I think there are very few things I haven't made. I've been down a lot of sort of you'd probably call them technical cul-de-sacs in my life.
Yes.
And had to back out, hoping no one had seen what I'd done. But but so I've explored a lot of techniques.
Yes.
And I get bored quite easily, so I move on.
Mm.
I mean, there are potters out there who've made the same pots for their whole professional
yes.
life. And
yes.
they're wonderful pots, they're excellent mm. pots.
But do you think they'd want to branch off?
I don't think they should. They're very good at what they do.
They're happy at what they're doing.
Sure. But I just don't seem to be like that. I can't seem to resist trying something else.
Yeah, you're more adventurous.
Well, I just get a bit bored of
it. Yes. Yeah. No, fair enough, too.
Yeah.
You've got to be sort of, influenced.
Entertain yourself.
Yes, definitely. Now, I think about 1997, you became the director of the Auckland Studio Potters, running classes and building kilns. Can you tell us a bit about that, Peter?
Yeah, I did. The whole pottery scene became quiet. Again, a political thing, as the Labor Party came in 84, and by the end of the 80s, the Fortress New Zealand had collapsed, if you like, and you could buy anything from anywhere in the world, which I think we'll probably all agree wasn't a bad thing.
Mm.
But at the expense of people like potters
creative
who are
people.
Making stuff.
Yes.
Mm. So it became quite tight, and so I ended up having to look for ways of making a living, and this job came up, and I'd been around potting for long enough to be able to take it on and know how to run a pottery for a school, if you like.
Yes.
And so that's what I did for 5 years, I think.
Mm.
And then I decided just to go back become a potter again. And by then things had moved on again, and I found the work I was making, which was starting to go more into the brick.
You're right.
Working with bricks.
Yes, you have a thing about bricks, don't you?
There'd been another market that opened up there. So
yes.
I must say, most of my life I've just followed my nose. And I haven't had a great plan in mind. It's very ad hoc, and so far so good.
That's good. So, yes, and you also were building kilns at the Auckland Studio Potters.
We ended up with about 13 kilns we got there. And at least four of them were brick kilns fired with wood or diesel. So, yeah, I was in my element there, to be honest.
Can they still use the wood there?
Yeah, we do.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
you're allowed to
We fired two days ago.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Mm.
Yes, I think in this day and age.
No, it's...
Because you can achieve so much better glazes, can't you, rather than electric kilns?
Yeah, you get a lot richer surfaces. The wood ash combines with the glaze and gives a different quality.
Mm.
And then you can use salt and soda and other things as well to make it even more interesting.
Okay, salt glazing, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Was there anybody sort of that you taught there or who sort of became quite famous
if I thought about it, I could probably name a few, but there's plenty of people out there still making work which they learnt at the Studio Potters. And the Pottery Centre itself is really busy even now. It's still very busy.
Everybody's still keen to learn.
There's a waiting list for the classes. And
health-wise, it's good for people, isn't it? They can get in there and create do their own
thing. It's interesting. The classes do vary. And then I taught a morning class, which was quite social in a way.
Mm.
It became a place, place where people went to see their friends and have morning tea and
In
the evening, it would be people coming from office jobs who they wanted to get their hands dirty, they wanted to put their heads down and make and learn.
Yeah.
It wasn't a social thing.
No.
Well, a little bit social, but two different things happened there, and it's quite interesting, really. Yeah.
That's interesting. Mm. Now, I believe you taught in Dubai for a while. That'd be quite interesting.
Yeah, that was only for 2 or 3 weeks, actually. But somebody over there who I knew had started an expat pottery class with it. Mostly wives of businessmen working.
Of course, because there's a lot
Dubai.
Of English
And there's a marvellous group of women, actually, and very hospitable, very social. And quite generous.
Okay. generous.
So, they paid for me to go over there and also paid for a trip right around the world, so I was quite happy to
do. Oh, did they?
Yeah.
My gosh.
So,
that's very generous.
Yeah. And I have worked in China, and I've worked in Italy, and I've worked in England as well.
Can you tell us a little bit about you're in Turkey? Were you?
I worked in Turkey for about a month, and they had an international symposium. I worked in a city, Eskişehir, which is famous for its brickworks.
Right.
And so there's about 12 of us from all around the world went along. And there was a park there, and they gave us as many bricks as we wanted and as help we wanted. And we built a reasonably substantial sculpture over a period of 3 weeks.
All made out of bricks?
Yeah, all out of bricks.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Was that your first sort of thing?
No, I'd already been... had a bit of a reputation
already
for bricks.
Doing bricks,
yeah,
yes.
So I made a lot of friends there as well and had a great time there. That was great, yeah.
And what about China? That's interesting.
I went there four times in the end, and I built a kiln in Fujian province near a city called Xiamen. Mm. And I've been to, I don't know, a dozen cities around China, mostly to do with clay and ceramics.
Right.
And bricks, yeah.
So there's still a lot there now.
Because they were amazing. Yeah,
that's where it started
many centuries ago. And then it went through to Korea, and then it moved to from Korea through to Japan, and then from Japan it was picked up by a guy called Bernard Leach in Japan in the 20s.
Right.
An English middle-class gentleman.
Mm-hmm.
And
I've heard of him.
he discovered the joys of making pots on a wheel, and so he brought that back to England, where he came from,
right,
to St. Ives. And from St. Ives, it spread around the Western world, and we became studio potters,
right,
which is probably defined as a potter who works all by him or herself, usually in their own little space, and have their own kiln, as opposed to a factory, if you like, factory potter. So, yeah, the studio pottery movement was kind of born out of that connection. Mm. China was the first place.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
Because we had Crown Lin and people like that, but, I mean, and they did bring out some...
Yeah, they brought designers, yeah.
Marek Mizek came out from...
And actually, Merrick's a good one to bring out because he came out as a factory worker and a well-respected designer.
Mm-hmm.
And his work that he made through Crown is very collectible now.
Yes, it is.
But then he saw the chance in New Zealand to become a studio potter and work for himself. And he was, in fact, I think, claimed to have been the very first studio potter in New Zealand.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and he worked in Nelson and places like that. And then
he was down in Tihoro, wasn't he? Out of Wellington.
I remember going to see
him there.
Yeah.
Yes.
He built two big beehive kilns there.
Yeah, salt glazing, I think.
Which, interesting, they're actually moving right now just a few hundred yards to make way for a motorway on ramp. Mm. So it's quite a job moving a kiln like that. There's about 4,000 bricks in his kiln.
My gosh.
So, he was a pretty important person. And then, of course, people like Len Castle were also...
Yes.
And Barry Brooker, they were both kind of in the teaching professions, but they were looking for a way to get out of it, I think, and they became very interested in making stuff. And Helen Mason, they were all sort of pioneer potters.
Yes, they were pioneer potters.
In the sense that, obviously, people have made pots for centuries, but they were pioneers in adapting New Zealand conditions and materials to making pots here without importing any material. So there was a lot of hit and miss there.
Because there's a lot of clay around, isn't there?
But New Zealand's actually not very rich in suitable clay for pottery.
Oh, okay.
There are some, but it's not as... Australia's pretty good.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
so where would the clay have come from?
People like Briar Gardner, who was part of the famous Gardner family in New Lynn. Partly they dug their own clay around up the Waitemata Harbour.
Oh,
but she also
imported
clay from England as well. So it's a
combination. Really?
Yeah.
Gosh, I didn't realise that. I thought most of our clay, it's sort of red. Would it be like earthenware?
It's called stoneware, which is brown clay rather than a red clay. Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Okay.
And even now, unfortunately, the local product is hard to get.
Right.
And we're importing more and more clay for studio potters from places like China and England.
Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, I met a guy who was an importer of porcelain, and he said, this is the best clay in the world, porcelain clay. It came from China. The pot came from China. The pot was made in China from clay, which was sourced from Japan.
Oh.
Clay in Japan was sourced from the Northland in New Zealand. So the best clay, and the best white clay in the world, went from Northland to Japan to China and back to New Zealand.
Ridiculous.
So there's a lot of air miles there, a lot of green miles.
Yes, it'd be a pretty expensive pot
when it
gets finished.
Yeah.
Now, you are a bit famous for your 6-metre-long brick boat. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, well, I guess that was down to my natural curiosity and problem-solving. I sat in a kiln in England some many years ago, late before the turn of the century, so to speak, 1980, 1995 or something. And it reminded me of a boat sitting upside down. It's what's called an anagami kiln, which is famous in Japan.
Oh, okay.
And it's like a giant slug lying on a hillside. And so when we were inside the kiln, it felt like I was sitting under a boat hull. Like you do down on the beach, you know, when you're a kid waiting, you know, hiding under the boats from your friends.
Yeah.
And so I started thinking maybe this, if it was turned upside down, would actually float. So eventually the guy who owned the kiln wasn't particularly keen on doing that. So eventually when I got home about 5 years later, I decided to try it out. And I just drew a pencil drawing on a bit of paper and took it from there, really, and this is my first brick thing I'd ever built, apart from kilns, normal kilns.
Yes.
And so I just followed my nose, and I built one like a kid would draw a boat. I just drew that, and I followed that, and it turned out to be pointed at both ends and a sort of a Gothic arch all the way up the middle. And it took 700 bricks, and took me about 3 months. I built it upside down, so it became like an upside-down boat, if you know, hull.
Yes.
Then I got a guy with a crane to come in and turn it over.
That'd be pretty heavy.
It was two tons, yeah, weighed 2 tons. And then, but I'd done the physics, I'd done the sums, and I was pretty confident. Then eventually,
that it would float.
Yeah.
You can't imagine it floating, can you?
No. It's sort of counterintuitive, really, but it displaced 3 tons, and so, in fact, it floated too well. I had to actually put ballast in it to hold
really?
It down. Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
So we launched it down at the viaduct at Dennis Connor's launching ramp when he was away.
Oh, good.
And it floated quite well. As I said, it floated too well, so we put 300 kilograms of ballast in the bottom.
It's hard to believe.
Yeah.
Is this the boat that's out in your front?
In my front lawn, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Gosh.
And a friend of
that's
mine,
amazing.
Jeff Thompson, built the sails for it, corrugated iron.
Out of corrugated iron. Because he does a lot of sculptures out of corrugated iron.
He's very clever. He's amazing. So it lasted about 3 hours on the water.
Yes.
And before I saw this water in the bottom I was standing in, and I thought, this is a bit weird. It shouldn't be leaking, but it was. It was actually seeping rather than leaking. I hadn't thought about that. The bricks get quite porous.
Porous.
They don't leak, they just seep. So after about 3 hours, we decided to pull it out. And that was the only time it's been in the water.
Yeah.
I am tempted to get it out again for the America's Cup, I have to say.
Oh, no, you should do that.
That'd be great.
Yes, it's part of New Zealand history, really.
That's right.
Might bring us luck.
That's right, yeah.
We're running a little bit short time, but I would like to ask you, is there anybody that has influenced you, you know, largely over the years in your potting?
Yeah, that's a hard question because I'm highly influenced by almost everybody I meet because a lot of people out there doing amazing stuff.
Yes.
And I had the good luck to be around when New Zealand was on the international scene for pottery competition and met a lot of famous people around the world. So, no, this might sound a bit flippant, but actually I my main influence was when I was a kid, we used a lot of crinoline and stuff from the local china shop. And so I grew up, when I became a potter, that's all I wanted to do is make the same as that. But, of course, over a period of time, you start to realise that the pottery, studio pottery, has the luxury of being able to play with the clay a lot more than the factories. And so
you could
produce works which actually look like they've been made by a person, like a human. And with all the dents and the foibles and the things that go wrong, which stamp it as being made by a person rather than a machine. It took me a while to realise that.
Yes.
So for a long time I made very straight pots, and I sold very well, and I made a good living. And then I started making wobbly pots.
All right.
Usually it's around the other way, but I went from straight to wobbly. And people usually go from wobbly to straight.
But, yes, yeah. Hopefully.
Yeah.
Yes. Now, you have, you know, your work is in several collections. Where could people view it? I mean, I think you've got some in the museum.
If you wander around Auckland. Well, if
and you've got all your sculptures.
Yeah, yeah,
yes.
Yeah,
where are they in Auckland?
Well, you can't go anywhere in Auckland without tripping over one of my ones. the three big ones out at New Lynn and the triangle at New Lynn, just near the main road there.
Yes.
Several on Waiheke.
I have viewed those. I've been on that sculpture walk over there.
There's a couple in the Botanical Gardens and Manurewa.
Okay.
There's four down there, I think. So there are different places around there. Yeah.
Okay.
And as well as being in people's backyards, including three in my own backyard.
Good.
For the cats to sit on.
Hope they appreciate them.
Indeed.
Now, where do you going to go to now, Peter, now you're retired? Are you sort of going to retire properly, or are you going to take some more classes, or just
I'm just going to stay home and make stuff. Yeah, and probably smaller stuff I can hold in one hand, except I have been making these what are called trip rugs, which I'm really enjoying.
Yes, that's fascinating.
In fact, I went into where I had one of them stored the other day and actually did trip over it. So it does work.
They work
very well. I'm having a good time.
Are you making the tiles yourself?
Those are actually French.
Those beautiful ones I saw.
Very Victorian sort of feel to
them. They're gorgeous, yes.
But anyway, that's what I'm doing. And I'm making small... When you start making a pot, you start by wedging the clay as you would with a loaf of dough when you're making bread.
Okay.
And you get shapes from wedging, which I find quite interesting. So I've actually been taking it as far as the wedging and then firing that rather than going any further.
That'd be interesting. So they're more like sculptural.
Well, they are
like
quite sculptural. They are sculptural, yeah.
Yes.
So I've just been firing those and glazing them and making... Taking it back to basics.
You're still doing it, which is good, because I can't imagine you retiring.
It doesn't work like that.
No, I don't think it would work with you.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for being with us today, Peter. It's been fantastic.
Yeah.
And I'm sure our listeners have enjoyed listening to you.
Yeah.
And you have chosen a piece of music.
Oh, yeah.
Would you like to?
Well, briefly, yes. A woman called Gillian Welch and her partner, not real life partner, but her musical partner, Dave Rawlings, is an amazing guitarist. She wrote a song called Red Clay Halo, which we had a little Potter's band. We used to play this quite a lot. And it's very few songs with clay, the word clay in them.
I can imagine that.
I'd like to just use this to close the show.
So this is Red Clay Halo by Gillian Welch and David Rawlings. And thank you, listeners, for being with us today. I'm sure you've enjoyed our program.
Today, listen every second Wednesday of the month at 2:10 p.m. or download us
anytime online at planetaudio.org.nz/DecoRetro. And we would like to thank our sponsors, Club Moderne, Art Deco Society Auckland. We will keep you informed of all future exciting and glamorous events to be held by Club Moderne. For more information, email judith.moore650@gmail.com. That's judith.moore650@gmail.com. Bye for now.